salad. I say, oh, we left him. He went in the restroom.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some. Do you have some microphones?
Yes.
If not, yet.
Okay.
Good morning. This is the City Council workshop for Tuesday, February 28th. Present today is Councilman McLeod, Mayor Gwynn, Councilwoman Rich, and myself, Councilwoman Heimbachel. And Mr. Owen is not with us at the moment, but he may be joining us later. The first thing I want to do this morning, we have had some upgrades to City Hall and also to the power plant, and we just want to take a few minutes to recognize all of the employees that were responsible and helpful for those upgrades and just commend you all on a beautiful job. Everything looks great, and it's very exciting to see all the improvements. So Mayor Gwynn and I, if we're going to come around the front and start calling you all's names, and we have a little token of appreciation for each of you. Come on up as I call your name. Janie Pope, Janine Robbins, Jeff Curley, Robert
Here,
Frady.
Before you, I just want to read what this thing says. It says you make a difference in our community, and it says thank you. And it says Mayor's Gold Medal, the City of Ocala, Florida. So this is what it is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Robert Frady, did I say Robert? Okay. Michael McCleary, Jonathan Scribby, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Robin Mills.
Okay.
Bill Parsons. Oh gosh. Gary Shamil.
Yes. There you go.
Jarvis Mulkey.
Hi. Thank you.
Thank you. Mike Finelli.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Brian Cruteau, Lamar Peebles, thank you. Theron Garman,
thank you, appreciate it.
Well, you made it.
Nicholas Rector, Aubrey Hale, Astrida, I'm not going to try, where is she?
Thank you.
Liz Houck. Liz Howe.
Appreciate it.
Stephen Chapin. I can't read any of your names. Darren Park. Tony Ewing. Tommy Gaines. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks. Mike.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. McNickney. Y'all are going to help me out. McNickey. Mike McNickey. Camille Matthews.
Thank you.
Brian Herrick. Charlie Hilton.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Bill Montemuro.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
John Lazador.
On behalf of Mitchell McCleary, I'm coming
to you. Okay.
Mitchell McCleary was a big part of this.
Thank you.
John Lazador. Paul Constable.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Raul Ropiza.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jarvis McAllister. Dudley Bass.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Joa McCormick. Bob Stallings.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Terry Palmer. Jeremy Mutz.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Sam Maldonado. Ron LaRoque.
Nice. Appreciate it.
Johnny Wade and Tracy Wills.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And there are three people.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Hi. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
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 Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And there are three people that work in our residential sanitation department that are out doing their runs right now, but they were also contributing to the projects. Donald Henry, Errol James, and Jody Taylor. So we thank them as well, and we'll send them a gift. Thank you all very much.
Does anyone hear that? Yes.
That helped out?
Yes.
We missed.
Chris?
We missed people. Come up, Chris, and tell us who they are.
Yeah, we arranged with Outback to trade these in for state dinner.
That's right. Exactly.
They left my name off when I did it.
Did they?
Yes, no,
well,
they did.
No, thank
come
you.
On up and go. Thank you very much. We have enough, guys?
Yeah, I got some more.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we got.
These are all the names I have. Man, somebody messed me up.
Appreciate all your work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate all your help.
That's right.
Appreciate all your help.
Purple day. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Cindy, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your help.
I'll tell you where.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well done, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Appreciate all your work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That was well done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Your right hand's for All-Star, not your left hand.
This is the All-Star right here. Thank you so much for all you did.
Yes, sir.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Last but never least.
Is that everybody? Okay, we're going to move on to our agenda items. Are there any, before we get started, are there any public comments? Okay, we've got several topics for discussion. The first one is the future land use element map changes. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Brower.
Thank you, Matt, President. I'm going to turn the time over to Bill Stevens, and he's going to go ahead and lead the discussion.
Okay.
Good morning.
Morning.
We're here to present to you an issue that it came about with the SunRail. That kind of died down and then came back to fruition and has recently been approved, where they had the groundbreaking in 2010. CSX desires, as part of this SunRail, to do a safety enhancement project within the city limits of the Ocala. Next slide, please. The S line, which runs through the city, has approximately 18 trains per day, and it's anticipated that you'll see an additional 7 to 8 freight trains per day increase within the next 24 months. Next slide, please. CSX plans to double track within the city limits to increase capacity, increase the speed from 40 to 45 miles per hour, decrease block crossings by providing a siding, as well as closing off two more crossings. The rail project limits is from approximately Southwest 26th Street to Northeast 34th Street. Also before you is the initial draft. I think I put a copy on each one of your desks of the original MOU, which needs to be revised based upon whatever decision you make today. The MOU's content is to construct a second track that will serve as a siding. Crossing safety improvements will be implemented. There will be two crossings in addition to the one that's already taken place and been approved by you. The CSX will reimburse the city water and sewer for a force main that was installed in the neighborhood of $41,800. CSX requires either acquisition or an easement from the city for properties that we own, and their initial offer right now is $75,000. Improvements will be benefiting the general neighborhood as well as the motoring public. In reference to our strategic goals, 3.5 is superior infrastructure and 4.1 to enhance security and safety, both will be affected. FDOT and CSX, as part of the closures, contribute $7,500 each, which is a total of $15,000 that comes to the city. That helps offset the cost for additional signage, and I don't think it'll facilitate any roadway improvements, which we have to undertake as part of our program. CSX is looking to close the two additional crossings. The first is Northwest 2nd Street, and the other, CSX will improve Northwest 2nd Street and Southwest Broadway to the crossing, they will implement a crossing that will be acceptable for a no-blow zone, which is requirements are a power out indicator, constant time warning, which advises of approaching trains regardless of speed, and four quad gates. Those are all part of the Federal Railroad Administration requirements if you do desire to implement a quiet zone. Next slide, please. Our obligations are to convey an easement for the double tracking or the ownership, whichever CSX prefers. We'll address any roadway improvements that we have to accomplish as part of our 2012-13 capital improvement program. Upgrade the Southwest 3rd Street, which is the city's obligation estimated to be $75,000. Close two at-grade railroad crossings, which Public Works has undertaken a traffic study. A copy is before you that confirms our beliefs that there's little to no impact on the adjacent area. The annual savings will be approximately $6,400. As a result of the crossing closings, we don't have to pay the annual fee to CSX. Northwest 1st Street is one of the ones to be closed, as well as Southwest 2nd Street. Fort King was the closure was approved by council, and at the request of the New Covenant Baptist Church, they also desired interest in doing the same at 2nd Street. Apparently, they want to expand their property further south, so they fully support that. And again, if you want to implement a quiet zone in this segment, all these improvements would have to be in place. Next slide, please. This slide, you may remember, this shows the location and the geometrics that are being undertaken by the church. The turnaround is on the east side. There's none needed on the west side since the fire department and can use the parking area to turn around. Next slide, please. And this is an aerial perspective of the crossings that are in concern. The X is the one that shows the current closing, which is yet to be implemented, but it has been approved. And the two in blue are what CSX is requesting as part of this effort. I'd like to turn over the presentation to Cliff Staten. He is Director of Community Affairs for CSXT, and he'll be assisted by Tara Hawkins, also with the Community Affairs Group. Just keep going, Sonny.
I'm Tara Harkins. I'm the Community Affairs and Safety Officer for the state of Florida. It's a pleasure to speak with you. We appreciate you taking the time. In front of you, if you would advance to the next slide, please. Cliff is going to speak to you in a moment, specifically in reference to the quiet zone requirements, but I would like to give you a brief, very high-level project overview. As Bill noted, resultant of SunRail, CSX is increasing capacity along the freight line that runs through the middle part of the state in central Florida here, throughout several communities, and Ocala is one of them. This will enable us to increase some capacity on our lines, and it would also enable us to potentially help you realize, as a city, some of the goals that you would like to. Specifically, and this map I know is hard to read because it is small, but this gives you an overview of the area and the places where we are going to be expanding, where the siding is. Next slide. This explains to you the current warning systems that are in place at the crossings that are currently there. As you can see, Southwest Fort King Street is listed as a closure pending because that has already been passed through the City Council's resolution. And additionally, we are seeking the closures of Southwest 2nd and Northwest 1st. Next slide, please. This is a map from our real estate department outlining the conveyance that we would need either via easement or sale of property from the city to CSX in order for us to complete the project. As Bill noted, my understanding is that right now our real estate department is, speaking of your real estate department, and initially the offer we put out is $75,000. Pending the recommendation of the council, that deal will continue to be brokered, is my understanding. Next slide, please. So what's in it for you? Well, there are significant safety benefits to Ocala, and I should mention that I was born and raised here, and my family still lives here. So both from a personal and professional perspective, I'd really like to see you realize your industrial development, your job creation, and your safety goals. And I think that the closure of the two additional crossings with minimal traffic impact is going to really put you in a good place if you desire to have a quiet zone in this area be approved by the Federal Railroad Administration. We are prepared to engineer the safety improvements that Bill went over, including constant warning time, power indicators, and four quad gates at two of those crossings. Additionally, with the consolidation of all three, if you count Southwest Fort King Street, which has already gone through the City Council approval process, including Northwest 1st and Southwest 2nd, as Cliff will go over later, will put you in a really, really good spot to have a quiet zone approved by the Federal Railroad Administration should the council decide to file. Crossing consolidation is a safer alternative. If the crossing doesn't exist, then there is simply no chance that there's going to be a vehicular or train incident there. And that benefits both the community as well as the motoring public. Additionally, if the crossing does not exist, there's certainly no chance for blockage by CSX trains. And because the siding is going to be going in an area where these two crossings exist, simply from an efficiency standpoint, it would certainly benefit the community to have them not exist. We are prepared, pending the council's recommendation and direction from you people on how we should proceed, to set up meetings with constituents in the community, outline the project, answer any questions that they may have, and hopefully get full community as well as council buy-in. Next slide, please. And now I'm going to introduce Cliff Staton. He's the Director of Community Affairs and Safety. He is a Quiet Zone expert, and he's going to talk to you a little bit about how the Quiet Zone calculator process works and what the city would need to do to potentially get this approved if you decide to file.
Morning.
I don't know that I'm a quiet zone expert, but I do all the quiet zone work for CSX Transportation in all 23 states that we operate in. So this process started approximately 4 years ago. We had some initial meetings with the city and the county on when we were first talking about this whole SunRail project and how that was going to affect some traffic movement between the A line, where that traffic currently is, and over to the S line, which brings it in this way. One of the things I want to point out is this wasn't specific to the city of Ocala. There's 18 projects that are happening all along this corridor to accommodate this additional train traffic and to increase our capacity level. One is just north of here, Anthony, which we're putting in a new 10,000 foot long siding that's going to give us the ability just to move trains. And that's one of the things I think I want to point out to you more than anything is the challenge of that. It becomes very, very hard to find a place to parallel park, if you will, an 8,000 to 10,000 foot long train without impacting crossings. So that was one of the reasons that these capacity improvement projects were so important and so imperative to the whole SunRail project. One of the things I think that I need to point out as well is that whatever we do in Ocala affects our movements in Anthony, affects our movements in Lakeland, Jacksonville, Atlanta, because we have a network system in all 23 states. What we do in one place dramatically affects what will happen in another location. So that's something that we need to point out. We just don't, we can't look at our operation specific to a city, but it has to, we have to look at that as how it's going to affect our overall network and ability to move freight in the United States. So quiet zones, if you go to the next slide, please. Thank you. When we initially started conversations with the city and the county approximately 3 or 4 years ago now, there were four different locations that were indicated by the city and the county of potential quiet zone locations. You'll see these marked on here, but it ultimately boiled down to, as it always does, is, and one of the things I need to point out quickly, CSX Transportation or any other railroad company does not pay for quiet zones, nor does a Department of Transportation, the state DOT, if you will, do not. And the reason for this is there's so many crossings that simply have a crossbuck, that they have no lights and gates at all, but there's just simply a crossbuck. In Florida, for example, there's only about 40%, give or take, that have some kind of advanced warning system. In other words, lights or gates to warn a motorist that there's an approaching train. So that's the reason the states and or the railroads do not fund these, is because there's so many other locations within any given state, and that's consistent throughout the entire United States, where there's nothing but crossbucks at a location. So a quiet zone ultimately, I guess, conveys more a quality of life issue versus, because we are aware that our train horns do make noise, and they can be very, very loud. I mean, it is what it is. But that's the way that we warn, if you will, the motoring public and or pedestrians that a train's approaching any given location. So that's the reason for train horns. Given the fact that so many communities recognize that there was quality of life challenges if you live in close proximity to the railroad tracks, the Federal Railroad Administration, who is our governing agency as from a railroad standpoint, developed a quiet zone rule in approximately 2005. And so this rule has virtually no flexibility to it. And if you'll go to the next slide, please. This is an overview. Forgive me, because of my eyes, I can't pick up the screen, so I'm just going to kind of wing it here. Where we are. But there's a quiet zone risk index, and this is a calculator within the FRA train horn rule. I've met with Bill with the city here, and we actually walked through the quiet zone calculator zone by zone and crossing by crossing, because anybody can get in here. You don't have to be special, but as any federal government website, sometimes it can be a little challenging, I guess, at best, to navigate if you're not used to it. So, but we went through each and every quiet zone within the quantum. And the bottom line is there's basically, it boils down to three criteria. You have to have constant warning time. What that is whether a train's going 5 mile an hour or 50 mile an hour, it gives constant warning time to a motorist and or a pedestrian that a train's approaching that particular crossing. The next thing is power out indicators. Basically, that's a light bulb on the side of our signal equipment that tells the locomotive engineer that, in fact, the equipment is operating properly. So he knows if for some reason there's a malfunction in any type of warning system, they go into a fail-safe mode. So anytime there's a malfunction, the gates automatically go down and will stay down until that malfunction is corrected by our signal forces. So power out indicators are required. And then you have to meet the risk index. And basically, you have to get your risk index down below the risk index with horns. And that's all done within the FRA calculator. There are some flexibilities with that. You can adjust the traffic count, for example. From a vehicular standpoint, you can adjust the train count from a number of trains standpoint. But then at that point, you also have to be able to, you can add warning devices. So basically what you have to do is get the quiet zone risk index below the risk index with horn, and you qualify for your quiet zone. A railroad company cannot say no to this. If you qualify for it and you meet certain criteria as set forth in the FRA train horn rule, you get your quiet zone. So it's not a thing that CSX doesn't have the ability to award a quiet zone. We don't have the ability to deny a quiet zone. The calculator is what the calculator is. And when you reach those numbers, that's what triggers that effect. So how do you get from A to B? If you go to the next. I think I've addressed most of this. quiet zones can be either a nighttime quiet zone from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. or a 24-hour quiet zone. Now, one of the things I do want to point out that the locomotive engineer always has the ability, when he sees anything that he deems to be a danger to the public and or to our employees, that he can sound the horn. So if he sees a person on the track, if he would see a vehicle going around gates, for example, or those type of things, even though within the scope of a quiet zone, it is at the locomotive engineer's discretion to sound the horn at that location. We have, and I'm going to knock on wood here, but fortunately, on CSX, we have in over 100 quiet zones on our system now, and because our work with communities we've done appropriate engineering and actually over-engineered at some point. And bottom line is, when you take the ability of a driver to drive around the gates, that increases the safety, and that mitigates the train horn. So that's kind of how we get, again, from A to B. So next slide, please. The crossings, and I think Tara touched on these and Bill as well. There's actually some crossings involved, and after numerous conversations and meetings with the city indicated that this was the quiet zone that they brought to us and they would like to pursue. And that's in the area from Northwest 2nd Street down to Southwest 3rd Street. Warning system upgrades would be required to get you to get you that risk index in the range that you need to get. And also, one of the things that I encourage communities, as vehicular counts, as population, communities grow, and or train traffic increases, in fact, you don't want to just barely make the limit on some of these things. If you can create a little wiggle room, if you will. These are revisited currently every 5 years by the Federal Railroad Administration, and so it would kind of be bad for everybody concerned if you end up with a quiet zone and then you lost it down the road because you didn't engineer at a level that created a good, safe traveling public. So some crossings here, and again, Northwest 2nd would be upgraded, and when I say upgraded, that's from a signal standpoint. And I want to point out that every crossing along this entire S line in all 18 projects was reviewed by the Florida Department of Transportation, local authorities, and CSX Transportation in this particular case, to get everybody's input to see what was the potential for crossing consolidation, because monies were going to be allocated through the project to increase warning systems or upgrade warning systems where appropriate, where they deemed appropriate. Northwest 1st Street crossing was agreed by the parties that it could be closed with no adverse effect to the community. Obviously, the state road, the overpass, is not an at-grade crossing, so that's exempt from a quiet zone standpoint. Southwest Broadway is to remain open, but to be upgraded from a signal standpoint by CSXT. Southwest Fort King closed. Southwest 2nd to be closed, and Third Street was to be upgraded at the cities. Next slide, please. The next thing, and I won't get into the nuts and bolts with this. Bill's, I think, fairly familiar, and I'll be available for questions if you have any. But this is an actual, the quiet zone calculator. And what I've showed here is the options. So you basically start, and in the box on the right, I've put the quiet zone risk index is greater than the risk index. In this particular case, it went from 14,007. And the risk index with horns is 16,097. So bottom line is you got to get below that however you can. So gates are required at all these crossings. On the next one, I showed that it's clearly in green that the risk index, once you close these crossings and upgraded the warning systems on the other, that the quiet zone risk index is substantially lower. In other words, it went down to 14,103. And at one of our meetings with the city, Bill and his staff, we went through this literally zone by zone and crossing by crossing to see exactly what the efficiencies were and how we could get along with these signal upgrades, the quiet zone risk index. One of the challenges that we face, next slide please, until, you know, one of the things that communities and cities continually ask me for is what's it going to cost? And the reality is until you do preliminary engineering on a crossing, those costs can't be determined with any kind of accuracy. One of the things that crossing consolidations really play into is constant warning time requires that crossing signal systems talk to each other. The closer they are together, the more circuitry it requires, and the more expensive they become. So in a lot of cases, if you've got a crossing literally a block apart, that becomes, from a circuitry standpoint, very, very expensive to accomplish. So that's one of the things we're crossing consolidations. And I did mention earlier that CSX does not pay for quiet zones, but what we do is incent communities for crossing closures. FDOT matches that up to an amount of $7,500 per crossing. So in this case, part of ours was a monetary incentive. Part of those were signal improvement incentives within the scope of this quiet zone. The next one, there were zones that I think at Bill's request, we included all these within the scope of this. However, the only one, again, that was really mentioned by the city that they'd like to, and from a funding standpoint, wanted to pursue right now, was this crossing over in the Northwest 2nd Street to the Southwest 3rd Street area. We have a couple options, and again, you know, at Bill's invitation, I was invited here today to speak with you all. So ultimately, it boils down to the city council and what does the city desire. The reality is, from a without the crossing closures, CSX really, and FDOT agrees, really don't have a need to upgrade the warning systems within this area. We can utilize existing equipment at this area. So that's one of the things. They are all lighted and gated crossings currently in this location. So one of the things that, as opposed to a small siding that we have currently, one of the great things for the city of Ocala now is we're going to have a 5-mile long siding through the city. And also with our new siding up in Anthony, it's going to give us the ability, instead of staging a train right here in town, we're going to be able to move our trains much more fluidly through here. So even with the increase in train traffic, going to be a much better situation. And obviously, you know, we have tremendous challenges you know, with stop trains, with people becoming frustrated and even in some cases crawling through or under a train trying to get to the other side. So that's going to eliminate the potential for this, so greatly enhancing, you know, safety to the community and our employees as well. Any questions?
Anyone have any questions?
This area out here in front of City Hall on Osceola.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how could you create, or is that a quiet zone now? Or obviously, it's not quiet. I mean, how would you create a quiet zone in front of there?
That would require signal improvements in that particular location, and that's this area we're talking about, correct?
Right. Yeah, I think it's one of them.
Yeah. So the signal improvements would have to be, so again, you'd have to have the constant warning time, power out indicators, and any other appropriate improvements that would get that risk index below the risk index with horn. And again, that's all set by the Federal Railroad Administration.
Okay. And is that, that's our cost, correct? I can't remember which one of these slides talked about who's responsible for what cost, but.
CSX and FDOT are going to absorb the cost.
Okay.
If for, as an incentive for the crossing, for the two additional crossing closures.
Okay.
As part of the incentive to the city.
Okay.
However, we did ask that the city absorb the cost in 3rd Street. Now,
okay.
Part of the land acquisition was going to offset that cost at some level. However, the city would have some financial responsibility.
Okay.
In that.
All right. Yeah, the one out front is so loud that, I mean, we stop meetings when that train comes by because you just literally can't hear in that conference room.
Yeah, and you know, and that again set by the FRA, the decibel levels have to be between 90 and 110 decibels.
Right.
And so that's, you know, that's our federal governing agency.
Sure. Okay.
Mr. Stevens, would you like to comment?
Mr. Mayor, I just want to be sure it's not the far the northern rail line that's the question. It's CSX, the one that you're questioning here. There is no.
Is that far to northern?
That's far to northern.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay.
That's okay.
Okay.
Railroads are railroad to me.
And, I've been to so many meetings, and you know, I take some bullets periodically, and it's not even our railroad.
And they probably take some for you, too.
Yeah, exactly. It all kind of works out.
I have a question. Could you just sort of explain how the closing of the crossings, for example, on Northwest 1st and the Southwest 2nd Street, how that benefits your operations?
Well, it... obviously, from a safety standpoint, and that's another thing that the federal government has dictated a guideline, if you will,
mm-hmm.
that the railroads and communities pursue closure and consolidation of 25% of crossings throughout the United States. One of those things that crossings a lot of times were put in many, many years ago.
Right.
And at some point now with vehicular traffic and also traffic patterns, there's not necessarily a need, if you will.
Right.
So
right.
One of the first things we look at is it going to affect first response in any way, shape, or form?
Mm-hmm.
The city of Ocala assures us that will not be affected in this way. So obviously there's that safety benefit.
Right.
There's also expense to the city, the municipality,
right,
and also from a maintenance standpoint.
Right.
But then, you know, there's also an expense to CSX. So that's one of those things we do always look for mutual benefits, and where we can find those, obviously that's a win-win for all of us.
Right. So we're basically consolidating those three to just the first crossing on Southwest 3rd Street, which we're looking at making that a quiet zone. That's sort of the scope of this.
Correct.
Okay. Could we just kind of go into detail about the financial obligations on the Southwest 3rd Street upgrade and
mm-hmm.
and who is picking up?
And forgive me, I don't have a copy of that proposed MOU in front of us. And,
okay.
And so,
which one is that?
Were you referring to the $75,000 for the city's responsibility?
Yes, and what does that include exactly?
Well, basically, that's going to be your responsibility to get the warning system upgraded appropriately.
And those are the signaling and
the signal
that sort
upgrade,
of thing?
That's correct.
And what about is there any street upgrades or that we will have to do, Mr. Stevens? Are there any roadway upgrades on that?
Yeah. There are upgrades required at Three Crossing, 2nd Street, which is handled exclusively by CSX, Broadway, which is exclusively by CSX, and 3rd Street, which is the city's obligation.
Okay.
And we were utilizing the funds to be realized from the right-of-way to offset our cost.
Okay. So,
do you mean street upgrades or signal upgrades?
I mean both. I'm trying to look at the whole picture.
Sure, absolutely.
So, I'm curious if you all will be doing the signaling upgrades at some of the other ones, the 2nd Street and Broadway?
Correct. We will be absorbing those costs.
Is there any appetite for absorbing the costs at 3rd Street as well?
That's a wonderful question, and I appreciate you asking that. We do ask the city to absorb the cost because bottom line is we wouldn't be upgrading without the need for a quiet zone. We wouldn't be upgrading this signal equipment.
But it does, I mean, it benefits your operations basically to consolidate that into that one.
Well, it does eliminate two crossings. So,
right, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
But ultimately, you know, our train, whether those crossings are in place or whether they're not, we're going to be running our trains anyway. It's just this is an opportunity to really enhance the safety in that particular area. And, oh, by the way, it does, the city at the end of the day does qualify for a quiet zone with the upgrades.
Okay.
But, you know, I want to be very, very clear that without those crossing closures, that's part of our, that's our incentive as part of the signal improvements, that area. So without those crossing consolidations, obviously we won't be making that financial commitment.
Okay. Yes, Mr. McLeod.
Maybe I stepped out. If I did, I apologize. There was some talk about an incentives of, did I see it correctly, $7,500?
That's correct.
And a matching incentive from?
From Florida Department of Transportation.
So $15,000.
15 per closure.
Mm-hmm. I think what we're, signaling upgrades are $75,000. Is that correct?
That's the approximate city, and again, I don't know that the preliminary engineering has been finalized yet, but that is the cost of the city's participation, and I think that takes away, because actually, I think the signal costs are closer to $150,000, but I think that Mr. Stevens had indicated, too, that part of that was you were getting part of that money from the land acquisition.
Correct.
The
total cost is $150,000.
Uh-huh.
We're applying the $75,000, the funds that we would realize from the right-of-way acquisition, and the $15,000, the $7,500 from CSX, the $7,500 from FDOT is applied to signage, but we don't know if there's any surplus that could also help offset the cost.
Okay.
Until you go out there and actually design it, you need to know the number of signs, the type of improvement. That won't be known until it's done.
Right. So the potential cost to the city still is $75,000.
At this time,
the total
yes.
is $150,000, and we're kind of taking the other monies and
correct.
Deducting.
But CSX has agreed that they'll work as best they can to try to mitigate that downward.
Mm-hmm. And so then my question was, to them, was whether they would have an appetite for incentivizing us further to the tune of $75,000.
If you would close another crossing, we would be happy to have negotiations with the city about that.
Okay.
I think he tiptoed around that.
I think so.
He didn't say yes, he didn't say no.
No, I'm just saying that we do incent communities to close crossings.
Right.
From a financial level.
Okay. And so from us, yes, Mr. Brown.
I've got to continue that.
Okay.
Manager for just a
Go
moment.
Ahead.
The city also, as you know, has some cost in improvements to the approaches that will have to be made. Can I invite you to maybe run that the flagpole a little bit and see if CSX would be willing to absorb that cost on the $75,000?
You could run that up the flagpole.
Okay.
Absolutely. We'd be happy, but we are, to be honest with you, we have to look at what we're going to do in the Ocala projects. We're very, very close to the limits of what we feel is fair.
Mm-hmm.
At this. Another thing that I do, you know, want to say from an approach standpoint, that city is completely at the city's direction. What type of street surface, if you will, whatever that decision is made, those are on your city streets and your property. And so we probably wouldn't get involved in that. Would we have some, you know, we're always, as Mr. Stevens can attest to, you know, we're always glad to have conversations and dialogue.
Well, certainly, we're both partners in this, obviously. And,
oh, right.
And the city's going to be responsible for the street improvements. If we can invite you to maybe run that the flagpole and see what the powers might say, we'd appreciate it.
And I will be happy to do that. And again, from the land acquisition standpoint, we've had numerous departments within CSX that have taken a look at this project. And I'll be happy to run that up again, if my direct answer to you. But we've had those conversations prior to, and we're probably very, very close to the limits of.
Let them know that council's very interested in that conversation.
I'm sure.
Thank you.
As are we. And you know, and I must state, too, that everybody within the city and the county has
sure.
been nothing but a pleasure to deal with. And I have to compliment you on your recognizing your employees earlier. That was very nice and a very, very big point. Sometimes we all have a tendency of forgetting the people that actually are out there doing the work for us.
Absolutely.
That was very nice.
Thank you.
Can I pay you a compliment?
Please.
Probably the nicest person that I've ever spoken to from CSX.
Well, thank you very much.
You represent your company well.
Again, in all 23 states and two Canadian provinces, I get to meet a lot of nice folks. So I really do. So thank you for saying so.
You're welcome.
Thanks. What do you need from us, Mr. Stevens?
We need any direction, Sonny. If you go to the next to last slide, there's two options before you. One, if you'd like us to keep moving forward to realize the quiet zones or go with status quo and bring back the MOU, which would convey the right-of-way and facilitate the conveyance of the right-of-way.
So option one keeps all of the crossings open?
No crossings would close.
Okay, yeah. And option two closes the crossings and consolidates the full. Third. Okay, what are the wishes of council?
Probably option two for me.
Option two.
Still deep in the water.
Okay, take your time.
Keep the initial turn.
And Mr. McLeod is indicating that he would prefer option two, and that would be my preference as well.
Okay.
So
we'll bring it back to you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And, yeah, if Ken had the ability to vote. So is there anything else you need from us?
No, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you for your time.
I appreciate it. All right, we kind of skipped down on that agenda. What are we ready for next, Mr. Brower? Would that be the land use changes or the wayfinding?
We're going to go to the wayfinding.
We're going to go to the wayfinding, okay.
I don't think anybody has an agenda with you.
Well, and mine's all funky, so I'm not sure it does any good.
Angel doesn't have one.
Okay.
Ty Chickasola Growth Management. I'd like to introduce John Bozzio with Merge, who's part of our VHB 2035 Vision Team, and he's going to give a presentation on wayfinding signs, branding, and city logo, and then we're going to try to open it up to get some comments from council.
Okay.
We've had three workshops, public meetings over the last 2 days, and we've got some good input, and so we're looking forward to it. The process is going to take about 4 months to get through this part of the design portion of it, and then we'll move forward with budget for next year for trying to fund some of it. So thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
My name is John Bozzio. I'm principal with Merge, and I'm going to give you a little introduction to the wayfinding project and take any questions that you have with it. I just wanted to give you a background on Merge. We are an environmental graphic design firm, and we focus strictly on wayfinding and signage programs with a very specific expertise in downtown community wayfinding programs. We've done a number of projects in Florida, including Miami Beach and Tampa. We've done small towns, large downtowns, historic places, and iconic places. So we bring to you vast kind of lessons learned as we've kind of gone through these processes. The one important thing I want to just mention about this project is it's not a signage project. At its core, it's a marketing project, and it's about the experience that people have when they come to Ocala. And it's about helping them find their way easily, helping them discover the depths of destinations and things to do. All too often, people think that I come into town, I run around, and I put up signs everywhere. That's not really the case. What we're looking at is building a brand, building an identity, and helping people find their way around in a very easy manner to present the city in a very organized and friendly, welcoming communication. We've talked a lot with the stakeholders as we've gone through this over the past couple days regarding what is Ocala's brand. And it's very important to understand that a brand is not your logo. Your logo is your logo, and your brand is the idea that is behind the communication that you're starting to present to people. So we've tried to really talk about things that aren't literal to Ocala. It's not, you know, your brand is not a gazebo, your brand is not horses. It's the ideas behind what makes this a special place. And we've heard things like family friendly, we've heard things like active and outdoor, we've heard things like natural beauty. Those are the things that we as designers can build upon. Will those other elements come into play? They certainly will. But as we talk about brand and logo, it's very important to kind of distinguish between the two. When we look at our branding elements, there are physical things that you use to communicate that. So whether it is the logo and a slogan, or it's the signage that we'll be designing, or if it's just the architecture of the place, all of those things build on that brand and build on that message that you're sending out to people when they do get here. From a wayfinding standpoint, we are looking at this holistically. Wayfinding is not simply signage. As I said, I don't come into town and run around and put up signs everywhere. You think about it holistically. So when someone pre-visits, before they get here, they go on the internet and they get information about the different things to do. Or they may be moving here for a new position. So they are looking at those different elements. Communicating that in a very consistent manner is part of this program. When they get here, they may have their mobile phone and they may be downloading a mobile app or scanning information in. All of that is part of presenting wayfinding information or just tourism information or city operations information. Environments, we talk about that. That is, you know, a landmark is how we find our way. If it's meet me by the clock tower or make a left at a water fountain, we use those to provide orientation and direction. So all of that comes into a person's manner and how they're going to find their way around town. Support information, things like visitor guides, maps, and brochures, that's another level of information where we're presenting wayfinding information, but also destination information, and that we're doing this in a very consistent manner across all of these mediums. And then finally, signage. Of course, that is a big part of what we're going to be doing. But if you think of that kind of big picture in, as I come up 75, what exits do I get off for Ocala? And then when I get here, what is that identity that tells me if I arrive somewhere special, that I've created kind of this sense of place? When then I drive in my car, I find parking, I become a pedestrian, and I get information there. Certainly, as I walk around, interpretive signs can tell me the story and the culture of the place and build that character of why this place is different than others. So all of these elements are part of this program. You'll see in this particular chart, we also have a kind of ring around the outside that how these other elements or other issues influence when we are developing the program. Things like cleaning up visual clutter, designing for a sustainable system, the approval process and phasing and maintenance, all of those things play into what we are developing as part of this plan. I want to show you a couple projects that just kind of communicate what we're moving towards and give you the sense of scale and scope of what a identity and wayfinding program can include. First, I'm going to show you is Yadkin Valley. Yadkin Valley is a regional system. It's four counties in northwest North Carolina. They wanted it to, it's rural, but they wanted it to appear friendly and active. The three components that make up the logo, the purple references the wine country, the yellow is the arts and culture, and the green is the outdoor activities, and then that makes up the Y that you see in the negative space. Again, it's the four counties. We had to get all four counties to come together and agree that they are going to market themselves as one unit. And that's important because they understood that they had a lot more power doing this together than individually going out and creating kind of a separated approach. And here you can see how the communications package spreads across many different forms of communication. So whether it is a mobile app, a website, signage, or a brochure, you're getting a very consistent message throughout the program. One of the first things we did was in their pilot program was that really this, there was no identity for Yadkin Valley. So one of the first signs that went out were on the highways that would promote the identity. And then you can see how it all works together with the signage and the marketing materials, promoting that communication, that single kind of graphic language. And then once you get into the downtowns and kiosks that give you wayfinding information, and then banners. So that what the banners do is when you go from town to town, there is one part of the banner that says you're part of the Yadkin Valley, and then there's a series of banners that can promote that individual town and take on their character. No different than here, if you had a series of banners that promoted historical information or activity information or technology information. Those are the kind of things that you can build into the program. And then brochures. And it's bright, it's colorful, it's active, it's not traditional. They did not want to go in that direction. Then a map of the area. And then interpretive signs. Again, when you get down on the ground, telling the story and the history of the place that builds the character of that experience. We worked in Miami Beach and developing the logo for the city there. I've said this to everybody. I'd love to tell you went through a million different design concepts for this, but we kind of hit this one early on, and they really kind of gravitated towards it. The idea that beach was bolder and separated them from the city of Miami was something that they liked.
Is that South Beach there?
Yeah. Nice. It was a citywide wayfinding and identity program. You'll notice that the signs themselves are very simple, the panels, and that's because of FDOT and county requirements. So we were guided by three messages per panel, certain typefaces, reflective copy. So the panel itself is rather simple, but then it bends back over the back of the sign and has some form to it. And that was kind of the overall idea that Miami Beach is more about style, whether it is a restaurant or fashion or architecture. We could all kind of buy into the style. So it takes on those different kind of more artistic forms. It wasn't geared just towards Art Deco or just towards the beach. That was too specific. The logo then got translated into a series of elements. So coming into a residential area, you can see it becomes calmer. The scale becomes appropriate. It still gives you that identity that you see in other elements. And in some gateways, they need to be a wow gateway. That's where you come in North Beach and you really want to present that sense of arrival at that point. And then their communications. And they did a lot of this. We developed the identity and the standards for them. And then a lot of these elements they do in-house to present a common graphic language of color and typeface. The police cars and the different department trucks all have that same graphic language, presenting a very organized communication. I included Frederick, Maryland, because that's the exact opposite. It's very historic and very traditional. You'll see that the signs are more historic in their appearance, a traditional base, more symmetrical. I think one of the things that we are proud of is that our systems are designed for their place. We do not have a style or formula to this. In Frederick, there are many murals around town on the sides of buildings. So instead of putting a sign up for the parking garage, doing a mural was part of the culture of that place and part of the character. So we could incorporate those kind of elements, not simply just, okay, a sign goes there. Getting people to parking, pedestrian information, and then again, interpretive signs that tell you about things you can do there as well as the history. I included a quick one for downtown Cary. That is similar in size to here. This is the logo we developed, and I just want to go where it came from. The original logo was, they wanted us to theme it around a dogwood, which is a theme that they were using a lot of streetscape projects.
This is North Carolina? North Carolina?
North Carolina, yep. And the first logo we developed was a kind of an abstracted dogwood leaf or dogwood flower, and they felt that that was a little stagnant. So I can go back to the larger version. By just putting it on its angle, getting the center to have a little bit more energy to it, and then activating the word downtown makes that downtown feel a little bit more active than where we were originally. So I thought that was sort of appropriate. And then you can see the menu of signs. We kind of brought together traditional posts with a very modern sign panel feel. Gateways are smaller in scale, but more sculptural. And you can see more of the vehicular directional signs. In Asheville, they had an existing logo that we wanted to incorporate the colors and the patterns. And you see we did that here with the translucent border at the top. But one of the important things that came out of the public meeting, similar to what we did here, was that they have a huge artisan and craftsman population. And bringing them into the design process was important. So we came up with some general designs and then had the craftsmen make the various finials, which were placed on top of the signs throughout town, very eclectic. There are quiet poems on the back that talk about Asheville. And again, the sign panels are very simple. Parking. The pedestrian signs are more to the scale of a village, but certainly colorful, eclectic, and energetic like the downtown. Kiosks have maps, a little bit more of the craftsman work. Maps that give you information about what is in downtown. Also information about a visitor center where you can get additional hotel information. And then interpretive panels that tell you about activities in the region. So if it's kayaking or mountain hiking, all those things, you're promoting that as part of the character. We worked in downtown Tampa and did the system there and the Tampa Riverwalk. The overriding theme of this was light and lightning, because it's a lightning capital. But we thought that lightning was something we could build upon, both in a graphic manner, but also in a physical manner and gateways, and there were just lots of different ways to interpret it. Working with DOT, the signs are very simple as far as the sign message, but then again, the backs of the signs. Pedestrian signs get you back to parking, which is important. Maps. Interpretive signs to tell you about the history of the streetcar. And then we just finished the audio tour signage, which as you walk around, you can use your phone, get information about the history, get information about where to shop and dine, and you're not creating a sign that has a whole lot of hardware in it. You're letting everyone use their phone. It's a static sign. They dial in and they get that information back. And the last project is Charlottesville. More traditional in its kind of approach to the gateway with a sign in the median. and then just directing to vehicular destinations that, again, in this case, they wanted a dogwood. We have all different ways of doing dogwoods. This is doing it as a graphic pattern. And then it eventually translates into dimensional, kind of more sculptural. This is getting welcoming to the historic downtown. Giving some identification to some of the smaller destinations. And then promoting things like in their downtown mall, shopping, dining, arts. It's hard to see that mall from the boundary street. So using that kind of as a marketing tool to let people know what is available to them as they pass by. And you can see that pattern becoming more three-dimensional. So these are just some examples to explain what we're starting to embark on. And starting to look at what the brand of Ocala is and then how that can translate into the identity, into signage, into all kinds of different forms of communication. Because and ultimately what we want to do is present this as a very organized, kind of caring and friendly place. So with that, I will take questions.
I think this is great. We've needed something like this for so long. What's kind of the process of how this is going to occur as far as coming up with an idea of what we want to do?
Well, what we're doing now is we're having the, we've had the stakeholder interviews and we've just gathered a whole lot of information. We are going to go back and we're going to come back in a couple weeks with basically design options for the various elements for the identity and for signage.
Yeah, I mean, I'll
just go ahead.
The one with was it Maryland? Was it
yeah,
Fredericksburg?
Frederick, Maryland.
Yeah, I mean, very historic town. Yeah, as is Ocala. I mean, you know, obviously different than Miami Beach. You know?
Right.
I would hope that we would have something that's very historic looking, very traditional and stuff that would fit in with our town, as opposed to South Beach, look. All these stakeholders and everything you're going to have, how many different stakeholders are going to be involved in this?
We've had three, and this is, including this, is the fourth, three public meetings where we've had various people.
We'll also be using our leadership group and some of our other steering committees part of the 2035. So they'll be working with us as we go through this process. But we also will, when we come back with those designs, we'll have more stakeholder meetings, so they will be able to present something to kind of, these are some of the ideas that we heard. Okay. And we've got a lot of good ideas in terms of, how can we use something to make it a little bit more historic, but at the same time, a little bit more progressive, and how can we use a horse, or how can we use something that's subtle and not put it as your main logo. So John has given us a lot of good options, and I think he's taken a lot of good input from the community to the last 2 days. So.
Okay. All right. Good. Once we decide something, we need to move forward with it and keep moving.
Right.
Any other questions, comments, Mr. McLeod?
No. I'm like the mayor. I think this is something that's we need to do, and the sooner the better.
Yeah. I agree. Mrs. Rich.
Ditto.
Ditto. So there you go.
But my design presentation is just as easy.
It might very well be.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your work very much. All right.
So any comments that if you want to do, just get through me and I'll pass anything along to John.
Okay.
Like I said, we will be having a couple workshops when he comes back.
Yeah, I just don't want all the stakeholders to get together, come up with a great idea, come back. And then we go, well, let's study it some more. Let's, have some more input and, just make a decision. Let's move on with this. This is great. This is really what needs to have been done a long time ago. And we somewhat talked about it when DDC was, in place. We talked about some things like this. But
yeah, and that's where it came out of was the downtown. And we started on the square, but we didn't have that expertise.
I can't tell you how many meetings I sat in on that,
Yeah.
Years later, here we are.
We'll get to it.
Shouldn't take this long. It's government.
There you go. All right, the next item is, are the land use.
Kirk Estrada's here with VHB, and we've been given a presentation on the future land use, transportation, and the recreation and cultural element.
Okay.
Staff is here to answer any other questions regarding specifically the cultural and recreation.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Glad to be back. As Sonny's getting us set up, I was a little worried when we came in this morning. We saw all the men there with beards, and I thought they were, we must have done something really bad on the future land use map, but.
You're safe.
Yes, so wanted to compliment the city for all the work, all the improvements they've done downstairs. It looks magnificent.
Beautiful.
Looking forward to seeing what you do upstairs now.
It's done, what do you mean?
Yeah, we're finished. We're finished, we gave out the coins, we're done. We got another 30 years, but I'm good.
And did you notice the second suit?
Well, as Ty mentioned, my name is Curtis Stratka. This isn't my first time here, but we're with VHB Miller Selling in Orlando, 225 East Robinson, if we need that for the record. I have Mr. Lawrence Lewis with me. He's one of our transportation planners and engineers, and Mr. Bill Ray of Ray & Associates here in Ocala. Today, we're here to talk about three different elements we've been working on of the comprehensive plan: the future land use element, transportation element, and the recreation and parks and open space element. I want to briefly go through the process we've gone through over the last year. As you know, the Ocala 2035 vision was adopted by council in the fall of 2010. We worked very hard with staff and with the community. I know some of the leadership members are here today. So they're still here as part of the process to continue to, you know, lead and champion it from the citizen level. As we've been working on the comprehensive plan amendments, working with staff over the last year, we have been going out to the public quite often. I know we've given some semi-regular updates to council. We've met with the leadership group a couple more times than I think that they thought we would. But we always appreciate their time. We met with a group of local developers and attorneys in October here in these chambers to make sure that what we were proposing was something that wasn't too outlandish. It's something that they're still going to be able to work in their business practices, and they were able to provide us with some comments and feedback at that point. We met with the Ocala Historic Preservation Advisory Board in November. They were concerned principally with the Fort King area, and we tried to make sure we made any accommodations or comments that they had as part of the process. In December, we had a public workshop downtown at the IHMC, which was attended by 40 or so folks who were able to come out that night. We met with the Transportation Planning Organization. I know, Mr. President, you were there on that day, mm-hmm. and had provided information to both the county and the city staff that were present. And we've been meeting with the Planning and Zoning Commission over the last month, a couple of workshops we've had with some of our commissioners here. So in terms of the future land use element, what we're doing is we want to make sure that the 2035 vision that the city spent so much time on continues to lead the way, and it's the first chapter in the future land use. So what we've done is we've taken, because we already have an existing land use element, we've put the vision and its new policies, new land use categories, any of its new criteria up front as the new goal one, and I'll go through those details in a little bit more depth as we continue. Everything else from the existing future land use element is being put into a new goal number two. And that way we want to make sure that, you know, in the past there were, you know, certain property specific amendments or policies that were adopted. Those aren't going away, so no development rights are being altered in that way. So those are still a part of the plan. We wanted to be very careful not to affect anyone's property rights. We'll also be going through that to remove any redundancies or, you know, just basic cleanup as part of this process. I'm going to show you the new proposed 2035 land use map in just a minute, but we wanted to make sure that it was consistent with the vision plan, which was a community, really community-drawn plan, where we had a design workshop and different groups drew maybe 30 different images of what they thought the city should look like in the future. And then the leadership group, they did their homework, they looked at all of them and said, these are the similarities, these are the common elements, and these are what we believe that the 2035 vision should look like. So we wanted to make sure we got that part right. We wanted to make sure, as I mentioned before, we continue to respect existing development rights. And we want to see if we could simplify the future land use map. Right now we've got, I think, 17 different future land uses, and we wanted to see if we could reduce some of those to a more manageable amount, which will provide some more flexibility for staff, but also for landowners, developers, and other applicants who may want to do business within the city. This is the proposed 2035 future land use map. I know that council has seen different versions of it. This is our latest and greatest, so to speak. There are 7 different land use categories. You can see right off the bat, red is downtown. That's the central core, includes the downtown square, North Magnolia area, the hospital areas. The purple represents a neighborhood classification, so that's where you find both residential, and single family and multifamily residential. The orange areas represent what we call medium intensity or special districts, and those are similar to downtown. They're mixed-use areas, but of a smaller scale. So if you think about the city of Orlando, and I'm sure you guys have visited there occasionally, you have downtown, and it's downtown. It's the center of the region. But you also have smaller communities like Thornton Park, which is a part of downtown, or a part of the city of Orlando, but it has its own little community. It has its own little feel. And I think as we go through the wayfinding and branding exercise, we'll be able to draw out what makes each of these places unique. The blue area is an employment area, so it's optimized for job created industries. Yellow is a low intensity area, which is a more conventional suburban development pattern, and you see that amongst some of the corridors, notably 200 to the south. So I'll go through each of these and show you what the intended character could look like. Here's a summary of the different classifications and what the allowable density for residential and intensity for commercial or office development would be within those. They are all mixed use categories with the exception of neighborhood, which it is mixed use, but it's a more controlled scale because you want to make sure that commercial development doesn't overwhelm a neighborhood. So it has to be compatible within the neighborhood. So it's okay to have a coffee shop or, you know, a small restaurant within the neighborhood to provide services that people can walk to easily. The central core was shown as high intensity on the vision, so we made sure that we kept that in place. As you can see, let's see if I can use the mouse. This is 441 here, and we wanted to continue the theme of unifying Ocala and bringing downtown across 441 or Pine Avenue to try to remove part of that barrier that there's a perception also on a safety level that downtown is only on the east side of town. So we want to promote some redevelopment on the west side of 441. The special district medium intensity areas are of a slightly reduced scale from downtown, and there's I forgot how many we have on the map. I think there's 12 or 13. And these really function as community centers or neighborhood centers. So where you may not have to go all the way across town or to downtown to go out to someplace to eat or to shop or even have a business there. Each of these districts we recognize is going to be unique because, you know, the MLK Park areas is gonna be very different than you know, 36th Avenue and Merritt Camp on the other side of town. So those will be described through policies in the comprehensive plan. And what we would like to do is a community plan for each of the different areas that further describe what the function of that area is based on the community or the neighborhood's desires for that area. And we've already done that with the West Ocala plan. As I mentioned, the yellow areas are low intensity and they're more oriented towards automobile travel and less so for the pedestrian. So this is more of the conventional suburban type development. You know, some people want to see it go away completely. Some people want to see it stay because that's the way business has been done. I think we recognize that and you have to provide a place for it to continue. But the point of the vision is we don't want the entire city to be yellow. We want certain parts of the city to be preserved for their historic character, their neighborhood character, or we'd like to see taller buildings downtown. So that's why we have slightly different colors on the map. This is going to be an area where we'll talk about best practices, design guidelines, where the city will encourage them, but not require form-based guidelines unless they're within a corridor overlay, which I'll also talk about. Neighborhood, those were the, I believe, purple areas on the map for both single-family and multifamily residential. We wanted to make sure that you know, our current neighborhoods and all the great tree canopy isn't taken away by non-residential development. Employment centers, again, designated for employment-based development, provides the city with the roadmap to make infrastructure decisions so that when a new industry or new business is ready to come in, the city has already prepared the area there. I know that that's one of the major projects up in the Northwest. A corridor overlay is not an actual land use on the map, but it's something that the city would apply to try to promote a little bit better standard of design. Council has talked about before how downtown development needs to start at I-75 because that's where people get off, and we want to make sure that it's inviting people to come to visit downtown, and it doesn't just look like a typical rest area that could be anywhere on I-75 or any other interstate. So that's the purpose of a design corridor overlay. And these will work with and complement the wayfinding program that Mr. Bozio discussed previously. Some other new future land use policies, we wanted to make sure that the vision is tightly wrapped into the comprehensive plan. So it wasn't a standalone effort. It's going to drive the comprehensive plan and any updates that the city makes over the next 25 years. We wanted to make sure that the leadership group has clear direction to stay involved. And I think even if they didn't have this policy, they would still stay involved and show up to our regular meetings. So, but this makes it formal. We want to prepare specific community plans like we did for West Ocala because each neighborhood is different, has different needs, and has a different function. And that will provide a little bit more detail for each of the neighborhoods than we were able to do at the visioning level, which was citywide. So this will allow the city to understand the needs and function of each neighborhood or group of neighborhoods individually. And also to put in the framework for design guidelines is another new policy we've added to the future land use element. So our next steps for this, we're currently drafting some policies that will deal with some of the administrative issues that deal with when you're changing from one future land use map to another. Notably, how do we deal with some lot splits or subdivision issues? And also, since the future land use element is leading the charge, how do we make sure that all the other elements are subordinate to it and to reduce potential conflicts or the perception of a conflict when you're interpreting one element versus another one? Staff is working on a new zoning map. Currently, the city has over 30 zoning categories, and it's up to 50 if you account for all of the planned unit development zonings. Many communities we see are trying to reduce that, and that's what the city's doing now. The first cut takes it down to 15 different conventional zoning categories, and each property will have a new conventional zoning category once the future land use map is adopted by council. And then we are also looking at making particular areas form-based code specific, so they would have a specific set of design standards and a roadmap to show where the building should be on the site. And this would occur at places where we've worked with the community already, such as downtown, or as I mentioned, in the West Ocala community, to make sure that this isn't a change that's being promoted by a consultant or by city staff, but it's supported by the community. This is a copy of the working consolidated zoning map, where staff has worked hard to take the 30 plus zoning categories down to a more manageable 15 or so. And it is consistent with the future land use map. This is something we'll have to bring back to you at another working session, but it's one to show you the progress that is being made at this point. I'd like to ask Mr. Lawrence Lewis to come up and talk about transportation changes that are being made.
Thanks. For the record, Lawrence Lewis with BHB Miller Selling. Similar to the land use element, the majority of the changes to the transportation element are related to the ideas of the 2035 vision. There are some editorial changes in terms of formatting, et cetera, but the changes that we'll talk about today are related to the vision. The first major change relates to the level of service standards. The proposed amendments are really to relax the level of service standards to allow more development in the areas that are identified in the vision. So, for instance, downtown, other centers, the idea is that by relaxing this level of service standards from, say, a D to an E, that level of service would not be an impediment for accommodating additional development in those areas. And so that's what this policy is intended to do. In terms of the existing concurrency system, this amendment acknowledges that there will be a transition to a mobility plan system. So this does not do away with concurrency, but does set the framework in place so that the city staff can develop a mobility plan and a fee system to fund and implement the vision. The idea is that the mobility fee would replace any impact fees if they are, you know, reinstated, and that concurrency would instead go away and be replaced with a mobility system that allows for flexibility in terms of how revenues are used for improvements to other modes, et cetera. Objective 6 relates to land use and transportation planning. And this, again, goes back to the vision. The idea of this new policy is that there are certain densities that are desirable in terms of promoting transit within various areas of the city. So going back to the future land use categories, there were some minimum densities that were set for some of those areas. And this acknowledges that there's a transportation role for having those minimum density levels. Objective 7 talks about complete streets. The general idea of this is really to look at the safety of all users. In other words, pedestrian safety, bicyclist safety, safety of people getting on and off buses, and not just people in cars. And so the idea is that in terms of the design of streets, that those aspects be considered and acknowledged in the policy. These are two specific examples related to landscape medians for people crossing the street, and also as a related item, talking about guidelines for streetscape and wayfinding to tie into this complete streets concept. Again, these are some of the specific elements that are often incorporated. These aren't necessarily prescriptive, but the idea is to lay out the general framework of what the principles are and what the elements are to actually achieve that goal. One additional component of the amendment is related to road dies, which is also tied to complete streets. The idea is that for certain roadways, there are traffic volumes that are actually less than the capacity, even for the future conditions. and that when you have basically extra space or extra more vehicle lanes than what's needed, there's the opportunity to look at how the design of the road is functioning and see if some of that space can be allocated to pedestrians, bicyclists, etc. So what this policy and what this objective does is identify where those roadway corridors are, and again, talk about the process for evaluating these. So again, these aren't necessarily set in stone, but does at least acknowledge that in terms of community input and analysis that's been done to date, that there are opportunities to look at the design of some of these corridors. This shows the three road diet corridors, MLK in West Ocala, 441 on the south side of downtown, and then also State Road 40 as it goes through downtown. One related concept is also looking at potential gateways into the city. Again, from an aesthetic standpoint, from a wayfinding standpoint, how those can be improved to not necessarily address the road diet, but at least improve the character of the roadways as they come into the city. These are some illustrative cross-sections showing, again, how some of those principles can be applied to these corridors. For State Road 40, there are two potential roadway sections that we identified. One that has a median treatment with a pedestrian refuge and one that does not. For US 441, the biggest change here is right now there are three lanes in each direction and a center turn lane, and at least based on the traffic volumes for the future, there isn't a demand for six lanes or seven lanes. It's actually for four plus turn lanes. And so what this concept does is show how one of the travel lanes in each direction can be reallocated. This shows it as on-street parking. It could also be just a bike lane or a wider sidewalk. And then the final image shows MLK Avenue, which is currently a four-lane roadway, and shows how that could be redesigned to incorporate on-street parking as well and have a three-lane cross-section, which is basically one lane in each direction plus a center turn lane. And again, the idea is that by doing this, you're providing more space for other users, such as cyclists, providing a wider sidewalk for pedestrians and to support businesses. The final change to the transportation element relates to the final goal on the concurrency exception area. And again, this was deleted in its entirety just as part of the transition away from a concurrency-based system to a mobility plan-based system that will fully be implemented in 2013. And so with that, I'd like to move on to the recreation and parks element.
This is the final element that we're currently working on. The first part of this entails incorporating the 2010 Recreation and Parks Master Plan that the community completed with Deidre Miller-Sellen, working very closely with Kathy and Jennifer and the rest of the Parks Department. So this adds a policy to the element, adopting that plan by reference and directing the city to update it every 5 years, or at least review it every 5 years to see that it still meets the needs of the community. This plan focuses heavily on connectivity. So how do we provide safe connections between parks and schools, and between other key areas of the city? Oops, I think I went backwards. Sorry about that. One of the key new policies is the need to put in a trails master plan and develop that to create a typical trail section, and also to provide a preliminary alignment for where the trail system could be. You need to think ahead, so when there are new development projects in place, the city can reserve or acquire that right away to make sure that the connections can be made and they aren't interrupted by something in between. The city, it's proposed that the city adopts a new level of standard, level of service standard for recreation and parks of 4.6 acres per 1,000 residents. A lot of communities in the past have used specific facilities, such as you need 2 picnic tables per 1,000 residents, or you need, you know, 1 swing set per 500 residents. And many communities are moving away from that and going towards an acreage basis to provide more flexibility for programming and land acquisition. One of the key ideas, though, is that it's not applied blanket over the city. It's actually divided into 5 different sub areas, so that each the city can assure that each of the areas has necessary park acreage within it. Probably the newest notable change is the addition of a culture and arts objective and policies below that, and that is to encourage the arts within the community. I think you saw in the wayfinding program in the city of Asheville how important the fostering the arts culture and community was for that project there, and they were able to incorporate a lot of local talent into the projects. So this policy would direct the city to continue support for the Municipal Arts Commission to develop a cultural arts plan and to essentially continue working with the leadership group to continue promoting arts within the city of Ocala. So at this time, we'd like to take any questions. I do want to note that we are scheduled for a Planning and Zoning Commission public hearing on March 12th, and that we would like, pending their recommendation for approval, come back to City Council for a public hearing to transmit this to the Department of Economic Opportunity on April 3. So we will be back.
Mayor Gwynn.
Could you back your slides up to road diet corridors?
This one?
Yeah, I think back up one more, make sure. Okay, yeah, that one, the one, go forward. Yeah, that map. I mean, tell me, I know we've had this discussion before, but I mean, tell me what you mean when you talk about road diet corridors. What do you specifically mean? What are you trying to do here?
Well, it could take on many forms. One of the more common ones is a reduction of the travel lane width. If it's 12 feet, that actually encourages a little bit of extra speed than if it's 11 feet. We probably wouldn't want to go less than that. You may provide other visual cues, like a wider median, to try and slow down some traffic. So for 40, I think we would look at providing wider sidewalks, which may entail actually going from the edge of the right-of-way in towards the road.
Okay. But, I mean, you're still going to have the same amount of traffic on the road. You're not going to reduce the amount of traffic that's on those roads.
I think you would see the most substantial change on 441 going north and south. That's been identified by also the TPO as a priority project, and they are working with the Department of Transportation to do a feasibility study on that now. And that's where that road has 6 lanes currently, 7 if you include the traffic lane. But the projected level of the projected traffic volumes only are for 4 lanes. So that means there's extra space that's not being used. And it really encourages people to weave in and out because there is that extra space.
Right.
It's also, as we've been told by the community, a barrier to crossing into the east side of town.
Right.
So if you can reduce the section that a pedestrian has to cross, you can improve safety because not everybody can cross in 25 seconds if it's 100 feet wide.
Right. Okay. But I mean, you're still going to have the same amount of traffic.
Yes.
I mean, I hope you're not doing this and talking about these road diet corridors thinking that we're all going to be riding bicycles around and, you know, walking from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, we're going to, you know, exchange one mode of transportation for another. You're not sending this up there thinking that.
No, sir. We don't make these recommendations without looking at the numbers first.
Okay. All right. But I mean, okay.
May I add one thing? even though the amount of traffic is the same, the one concept of the, or one important part of the diet is that the speeds will be slower.
Right, so, no problem. Yeah, that's good. That would be a good thing, yeah. Yeah, it needs to be slowed down through there. But I mean, as far as, you know, getting across the street, all you have to do is change the time the light stays red and give people more time to cross the street. That solves that problem, correct?
It can. It needs to be coordinated up and down, up both upstream and downstream.
One of the things on the Pine 441 was when they closed that light off at Broadway. One of the things that the study may will look at is seeing if that could be put back in and DOT could support that.
Yeah, I mean, it's shocking that, you know, FDOT builds a little area there so that people can jaywalk and violate the law when they can walk 50 feet up the street and cross at a, you know, traffic light. So.
And also, where a road diet may be helpful is when a lot of times it's the intersections that are the problems or the failures.
Right.
So if actually, like on Pine, you were to fix those intersections, you would actually move traffic a lot more and faster through than having that extra lane that nobody is using.
Yeah, but that intersection at 40 and Pine is a problem anyway. I mean, we have, you know, serious wrecks there frequently that needs to be fixed. You know, it's with what you're talking about, but I'm about doing, I think, is perfect, but not to think that we're going to all be riding around on bicycles and walking, you know. But what you're doing is great, just for a different reason than I'm thinking about.
Any other comments or questions?
No, I just, the MLK from 40 to Northwest 10th Street on the blue, mm-hmm. thing there. Again, I don't know how, what, but just the feasibility on roundabouts down through there. I don't know how we get to that and tying in the roundabouts, plus I think extra wide walking and biking and all of that. That would be a great place to start. Mm-hmm. Right? It seems like just right, I don't know how we get there, but at least start looking at that.
And if you're going to do roundabouts, do real roundabouts. Don't do the ones like we have on Fort King, which aren't real roundabouts.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
They're not real.
Well, if you go to Sarasota, you go to St. Armand Circle, you know, those are real roundabouts. You go around and you veer off and you go to different, you know, areas, and this one's just a...
Yeah. Having a resident on the design team, I can assure you, it will be the, you know, the...
No, you know what I'm talking about,
oh,
right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great way to move traffic out of there and, you know, without having to, you know, have, you know, stop signs and curbs. And it just, the traffic flows the way it's supposed to.
Okay. Any other comments? Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anything else today? Are we,
that is all that Steph has this
business?
Afternoon.
All right. Any public comments on anything that we have discussed today? We are adjourned. I mean, I don't know what you're talking about. If you're asking that. They're bigger?
Obviously. Yeah, they're like this. Like if you're coming in here. We go around here, and let's say there's a road here. This will continue going there.
Oh, I see.
And you like to Sarasota.
Yeah, gotcha.
And then, you know, they just, you know, wear out like that.